It didn't take long after the introduction of television for shows designed to entertain kids to appear. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It wasn't until 1969, when Sesame Street debuted, that the revolutionary idea that television could be used to teach children important things began to catch on. Now, 44 years later, there are multiple television channels devoted to kids' educational programming and countless educational video games, apps, and devices. Today, I'll talk with Douglas Gentile, a developmental psychologist at Iowa State University, about how educational media affects our kids, and Trista Peitzman, pre-K through 12 coordinator at Iowa Public Television. We want to know how you use educational media in your house. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. When the Children Television Workshop debuted their new show, Sesame Street, in 1969, the idea that television could be used to teach kids important things like how to count, how to read, how to get along with each other began to spread. That was more than four decades ago, and now there are multiple 24/7 television channels devoted to kids' educational programming. And there are educational video games, apps, electronic devices, screens are everywhere today. And this hour, we're going to talk about educational media, how we use it, and what it does and does not do for our kids. You're welcome to join our conversation this hour as well. Let us know what you think. How do you harness the power of educational media in your house? How have you not been happy with it? Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With us is Douglas Gentile. He's a research scientist and associate professor of developmental psychology at Iowa State University. He has done extensive research on video games and other media and how it affects our children. Hello, Doug.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for coming back to the show.
Oh, my pleasure.
Also with us today is Trista Peitzman. She is pre-K through 12 coordinator at Iowa Public Television. Good morning, Trista.
Good morning.
So when I was a kid, we had Sesame Street, The Electric Company, and Captain Kangaroo. And so if somebody grew up with that and they haven't yet dipped their toe into the world of educational media for kids today, can you paint us a picture? PBS obviously is no longer alone in educational media, but it's still a leader. Can you give us an idea of all of the different platforms that you work on?
Well, I can tell you that educational media has really changed in the last 10 years and even in the last 5 years, because a lot more money is being devoted to the research that can go into making those television programs really great. So we do still have programs like Sesame Street, and now The Electric Company is back as of 2009. So we still have programs like that, but they are much better because of the research dollars that have gone into determining what makes a great television program for children, what is going to give it that educational stickiness to keep kids there and to help them learn those critical skills that they need to learn, and also make it really appropriate for them. So Sesame Street really started us down that path 40 years ago, but we've come much further today, and it has expanded beyond the television set, as you know, to online games on the computer, but also now mobile games and apps for smartphones and for iPads that can really go beyond what the television could ever do into the lives of children at school and on the go.
And Doug, that's just one network. So give us the bigger picture, because PBS obviously isn't the only organization out there making educational media. There are so many people who are developing games and apps and other things to entertain and educate your kids.
Certainly this is an important market for game developers and app developers. And you're right, there are many cable channels. Nickelodeon has channels. And some of them have actually done some very innovative things. For example, the show Blue's Clues did a really interesting change in format, where every day in the week was the same show rather than a new show each day. And the idea was to get children to start being willing to actually talk back to the television, to make it more interactive, even though it still is just a television program. The host would ask children a question, would ask them to find something on the screen, would ask them to say something. And so what they did is they actually had the same show 5 days in a row. And their research also found that, yes, this did help children start learning the show, learning what to answer, and being more interactive with it. So there are really some innovative ideas out there now.
Absolutely. And as I mentioned as well, there are so many different ways that kids can interact with media now because they play with their parents' phones. They use their parents' iPads. Some kids actually have iPads. And there are companies that are devoted to creating devices that kids can play their own games on. LeapPad is one of them. The LeapFrog company has a sort of like a tablet computer, kind of. And VTech is another one. There are a lot of people who want to put these devices into the hands of your kids. Right, Doug?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And let's go back to Sesame Street, where it all started, because I think one of the things that's surprising to the generation that grew up with it is we've forgotten why it started, that in fact it was started as a type of Head Start program to try to get less advantaged children who may not have the same access to preschools or to books or things like that, to give them the same basic skills that when they entered kindergarten, they already knew their letters and their letter sounds and numbers and things like that, the same way that the more advantaged children would do. And it turns out, it was fantastic at it. And this is one of the things that Sesame Street did better than anyone else initially and has been the model, is that not only did the show come with a curriculum, but it came with a research agenda to make sure that it was meeting that curriculum. And the research on Sesame Street, now over 30 years later, we're finding that kids who watch Sesame Street as preschoolers are still getting better grades in high school. That's how powerful the effect can be.
And of course, Sesame Street itself, as you mentioned, Trista, there are a lot of ways that kids can interact with these PBS shows, too. On my phone, I have a whole slew of Sesame Street podcasts, video podcasts. There's one for every letter of the alphabet, and there's one for many different vocabulary words and things like that. So now Sesame Street is reaching out in different ways as well.
Absolutely. And that's very common for educational programs to reach out beyond the television set, because we know children are online and they are mobile with their parents' devices or devices of their own, as you say. And so it's just another way that we can help families to provide those educational opportunities to those children, as Doug mentioned, that may not have those opportunities as well. In my work, I'm able to talk with many families. I work with many low-income families and working families, and some of them don't have those devices yet, but others do. And as they get those devices, we want to be there with those educational alternative programs for them.
And Doug, we hear the recommendation from the American Academy of Pediatrics that children under the age of 2 should not be watching TV. They should not be having screen time really of any sort. Children over the age of 2 in those preschool years should be limited to an hour or less of screen time every day. Now, we know that in a lot of households, those guidelines are not being followed. And I have had a few bad days myself in my household. But right now, with so many people introducing screens to their kids so young, do we know of any benefits that kids that are 2 years old or even younger can get out of interacting with an iPad or something like that?
Well, the research is still young, but there are some hints. First of all, preschool age children, so say 2 to 5, 2 to 6, when they interact with quality educational programming, there are a number of really fantastic benefits they can get from it. Younger than 2, although there are lots of types of programs and DVDs and videos that are marketed to young children, the whole Baby Einstein series, for example. The research on those is showing that, in fact, the American Academy of Pediatrics was probably right, that they don't seem to have very much benefit for babies. And, in fact, there may be some long-term harms, because what we know about what builds healthy babies' brains is doing things, not watching things. And there's a classic study in psychology called the Kitten Carousel Study. And so picture a little circular room. And in the middle of the room, there's a post sticking up, and across it is a crossbar. And down from one end of that crossbar hangs a little harness, which you can put a kitten in. And so it can walk around in a circle in the room. On the other end of that crossbar is a little basket, and you can put a kitten in that one. So one kitten can walk around, and the other kitten gets carried around at exactly the same rate that the walking kitten does. And you take these kittens, you raise them in the dark, except for when they're in this room. And After basically training them to move around in the light only in this room, it turns out only the kitten that walked on its own learns to see. The kitten that was carried around saw exactly the same stuff because it had exactly the same amount of motion because it was linked to the other cat. That one doesn't learn to see. So what builds healthy brains is doing things, not watching things. And so when we put children in front of these infant-directed videos, we think we're doing them a favor, but we're not. We're doing ourselves the favor, because sometimes you need a shower.
Right.
Sure. but in that case, recognize you're doing yourself the favor. You're giving yourself 30 minutes of time to, you know, take a shower or make dinner or something like that. But it's not really helping your baby. What helps your baby is actually playing with the blocks.
So the question is, I mean, when I talk to my pediatrician, she counts any kind of screen as screen time. That's her recommendation, is that, you know, my kids in their age group, you don't want them to have more than 2 hours of screen time a day, no matter what screen that is. Is playing a game on an iPad doing something or watching something?
Well, I think right now the conservative answer is, it seems like the effects of, say, playing games are pretty similar to the effects of watching television, that if you're playing high-quality educational games, it has some benefits. If you're playing, say, violent games, it can increase aggressive thoughts and feelings just the same way that violent television or movies can. So it doesn't seem that different yet. And so I think right now the good conservative answer is, yes, all screens probably count equally. That said, if the screen is being used for specifically educational purposes, you're doing research for your homework or something like that, that doesn't count in your 1 to 2 hours of screen time then, because that's actually helping you with your schoolwork rather than being entertainment use.
Interesting. Well, we're going to have to take a short break, and we'll be back to this conversation in a moment. This hour, we're talking about educational media of many different varieties, what we know about what it can do for our kids, what it can't do for our kids, some of the negative effects of different kinds of educational media as well. And with me this hour is Douglas Gentile. He's a research scientist and associate professor of developmental psychology at Iowa State University, and Trista Peitzman, pre-K through 12 coordinator at Iowa Public Television. You are welcome to join the conversation as well. 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about educational media, what it can do for our kids, what it can't do for our kids, some of the negative side effects as well. And we want your stories and your questions today, too. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me is Trista Peitzman. She is pre-K through 12 coordinator at Iowa Public Television, and Douglas Gentile, a research scientist and associate professor of developmental psychology at Iowa State University. And I want to talk about some recent studies. And Trista, I'm pretty sure that you're familiar with one very recently that came out that showed that kids who watch educational television as opposed to entertaining kids programming, I mean, educational programming is entertaining. I'm looking for another term for that. But other kids programs actually have better behavior than the kids who watch those other shows. And in that study, it showed that if kids were watching violent cartoons, for example, as opposed to educational programs, then they are more likely to have physically violent outbursts. And when you read that study, I'm sure that was delightful as somebody who works for public television. But what else did you see in that?
Well, I think Charity, that so often if we just think about some common sense measures, and as my parents would have said, garbage in, garbage out, and that's kind of what we get. We know that preschoolers are wonderful imitators of what they see and what they hear. And so if children are watching programs that promote kicking and hitting and, you know, moves that could be violent, of course they're going to try out those moves. And so, yes, I did read that research. I know that that is the case. You can see it with your own children, depending on what they are watching. And so that's why, I guess, in my world where I'm working with parents and I'm working with caregivers and teachers and librarians, it's just so important for parents to understand what is appropriate for their child to watch. And not everything in cartoon form is necessarily an educational program for their child. You know, it's important to know what are they watching, number one, and then is it age appropriate? Because children's educational programming can be broken out into many different categories. What's appropriate for a three-year-old is not necessarily appropriate for a six-year-old and vice versa. So it's more about, really understanding what makes an educational program different from simply entertainment, and then looking out for those things that you really don't want to introduce to your children, like violence or, say, commercials.
And, Doug, you have done some research about some of the different kinds of behavior that can be inspired by programming. And in your research, you've actually looked at some kinds of negative behavior that can be inspired by educational programming. And one of the things that you point out is that there can be a higher level of relational aggression. So negative interactions with siblings or with friends than from watching some of these educational shows. What did you find?
Well, yeah, and you know, if we look across all the research that that I and my colleagues have conducted, we do find, you know, it's not just garbage in, garbage out. It's, you know, all the you know, benefits in get benefits too. So when kids are watching pro-social programming, they tend to behave in more cooperative and helpful ways. They tend to have more empathy for other people. If they watch programs in which the good guy wins through aggression, then they start having more positive beliefs about the use of aggression and start being less inhibited to aggress when they are provoked. What was surprising, though, is we were doing some studies of longitudinal studies of preschoolers where we were tracking the same kids across a year or two, and we were looking at all of the types of programming they were watching. Now, most of these kids weren't watching violent shows. They weren't watching adult programming. They were watching specifically appropriate, age-appropriate shows, or at least that's what their parents thought were age-appropriate. And we asked the parents, you know, how much of the shows that they're watching are educational, what are their favorite shows, and how much violence is in them, how educational are they. And the surprise was that not only did we replicate what we had found in other studies that, yes, if they're watching violent shows, then they tend to be more aggressive. But in fact, if they're watching educational programming, then they also tended to not only learn the educational material, but also start being more relationally aggressive. Now, relational aggression is a non-physical form. It's where you actually try to harm someone or get what you want through the use of your relationship. So you could say, I'm having a party and you're not invited. Or I won't be your friend unless you give me that toy, things like that. And it turns out that this type of aggression may actually be more damaging than physical aggression in the long run. Because if I hit you, yes, you get a bruise, you fall down. In 4 days, the bruise is gone. And if you think I'm going to, you know, be physically aggressive towards you again, you can avoid me. But if I spread a rumor about you that damages your ability to have good relationships with everyone else in the school, that can follow you for years. So relational aggression is starting to be studied much more than it ever had been in the past. And what we found is that kids who are watching educational shows as preschoolers, not only do they learn the educational content, but they also tend to end up being more relationally aggressive, which was surprising.
So a lot of these shows, of course, you know, there's a narrative arc, and to write a story, you need some conflict. So in an episode of, and you mentioned Arthur in mm-hmm. your study, which is a show on PBS, and it's about an aardvark and his family and friends. And so there has to be some sort of conflict in the story. In a lot of those episodes, the conflict is someone being unkind to someone else, and then it is resolved by the end of the show. So the idea is that kids should be learning to solve their problems. But you're saying that they're not necessarily taking away that message. They're also imitating the negative behavior.
Sure. Well, part of the problem is that young children actually have a very hard time following plot. There's some great studies where you take children's shows, you chop them up into little bits, randomly reorder them, and kids can't tell the difference. So they are not understanding how the end of the show, where the conflict gets resolved, how that relates to the middle or the beginning. If what they get is 20 minutes, you know, say a superhero show, you know, 28 minutes of fighting is exciting, and then 2 minutes of, oh, it was bad, because the bad guy goes to jail. They don't understand. They can't conceptually change their understanding of the first 28 minutes. They got 28 minutes was fighting is good and 2 minutes of fighting is bad. And so they can't do the complex cognitive processing that adults can. And so that's part of the problem. If the show models relational aggression, and many of these preschool shows, they don't include physical aggression, but they do include types of relational aggression where people ignore each other on purpose to annoy them, or they get angry and call them names, or they spread rumors about them. Then at the end, even though it's resolved, the children have still seen relational aggression modeled in a show that they really like from characters they like.
And I have a personal example of that happening. I'm going to pick on Arthur a little bit more, but my daughter had an Arthur book and really wanted to watch the show, and she was 2 years old, and it's not a show intended for two-year-olds, so this is my bad on that. But I finally gave in, and I let her watch it. And that was the first day she ever said anything negative about her baby brother. And on the show, there is a lot of arguing and fighting between siblings. And she adored her baby brother. She still adores him, although he's five. And I was just stunned by how quickly that happened, from her seeing it and hearing it really for the first time in her life to repeating it.
Well, it is surprising. Kids are much smarter than we imagine, and and humans in general are fantastic learners. We just need to see something once, and we've learned it. We don't even try to learn usually. We're just, the minute we see it, we've already learned something.
There was another episode with her when she was 2 years old. We were watching a show that I really like called Pinky Dinky Doo, and that was on Noggin or one of the Nickelodeon channels. And it's a show about a girl and her little brother, and she's always telling stories. So when there's a problem, she has a made-up story that helps to solve that problem. And they get along beautifully. So I was really happy with that. And she was watching that show, and all of a sudden, she stopped wanting to go to preschool. And finally, I put two and two together, and there was an episode of that show where the little brother had been so nervous about going to school that he didn't want to go, and his big sister helps him feel okay about it through this made-up story. But she was imitating the anxiety behavior as well.
Well, yeah, and one of the funny things about the way preschoolers think is they will latch onto one idea often, and they'll miss the bigger picture. So, for example, there's a classic study done in Wisconsin where they showed kind of documentary footage of snakes, and what the voiceover said is something like, you know, although most snakes are not poisonous, you know, trying to get people to feel better about it, the children, the minute they heard that word, even though what it was said was not poisonous, from that point on, they got very scared of snakes. So many times, children will latch onto just one concept, even if that's not the one we expected they would pick up.
Well, and Trista, as I mentioned, when I let my two-year-old watch Arthur, that was a mistake on my part, because that's not a show that is targeted to children who are that young. That must be a real challenge for you with having a television network where you have all of these shows that are designed for different age groups. But of course, a parent can turn the television on at any time of the day. How do you think about that?
Well, I can tell you that we do have over 12 hours of educational programming on for children each day. And obviously, we don't want children watching 12 hours of television a day. And not every television program is designed for one age group, as you mentioned. You know, I taught second grade for 5 years, and I used the Arthur program in that second grade classroom to really deal with that relational aggression. And those children are cognitively able to follow the storyline and follow the plot and understand it and then relate much better in the classroom toward each other. So there again, if you look at the program and who it was designed for, looking at that audience, Arthur is not designed for preschoolers.
Right.
It's really designed for those early elementary school children. There are some great programs that have been designed for preschoolers working on early literacy skills, early math skills, and those social-emotional skills. One that just came out recently is Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood, which is based on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And when children are watching that, they are watching, you know, preschoolers are watching something that's age-appropriate. And I think you're going to see much better outcomes letting your children watch that if they're at that preschool level. So it is a challenge to help parents understand what is appropriate for their children. And I think the easiest thing for parents to do is to simply watch with their child, to sit down and watch one episode with their child to see, what is this program really teaching my child? Are they teaching letters and numbers and what we think of as educational skills? Is it teaching social emotional? Is it really teaching what we expect it to as parents? Is it following what we teach in our own home? And if it isn't, then, you know, turning it off is the best option. We really want parents to think selectively about what they watch, let their children watch, just like they are choosing healthy meals for children. And so not just turning it on and watching whatever happens to be on air. And especially in our day and age when we can DVR and everything like that, we've got so many options now. Just really thinking intentionally about what we let our children watch. And when, you know, you had talked about children under two and viewing under two, and we don't encourage viewing under two. But yet the reality is that 43% of children under the age of two watch television every day. And especially, you know, as a parent, that second child
right.
is watching a lot more television than we really want them to. But setting limits as a parent is so important. And television can't set those limits. Your three-year-old is not going to set those limits, but you as a parent really need to step up and set limits about what's appropriate to watch in your home and how much time is appropriate, and then really think about moderation. There are so many other things that they can be doing as well, and that's why we have our kids' clubhouse host, Dan Wardell, going around the state talking to children, telling them stories in libraries and schools every day practically, over 65 libraries every summer that he visits, talking to children about some really simple messages like turn the TV off, go outside and play, read a good book, and use your imagination. Really, it's a message about moderation and thinking about a time and a place for everything and making those healthy choices.
One of the things that you mentioned earlier, Doug, was how the show Blue's Clues was designed to get kids to talk to the screen and interact with the screen. And I see a lot of different shows that use that device. Some use it well and some don't use it well. I've always been interested to see which things my children will respond to and which things they won't respond to. But does that make a difference if there's a show that engages your child in that way?
I don't think we really know from the research yet that theoretically it should. This is also one of the things we expected about video games, that if you're interacting with the game, that's different than just passively observing something. And we expected that we would find a much bigger effect of, say, video games than television or movies. We expected that perhaps more interaction with the television would lead to learning more from it. And the research isn't really all that clear. Some studies show maybe there is a little bigger effect, and others make it look like it's about the same size effect. So I think we don't really know the answer to that.
Trista, you have an interesting example of how kids can get an educational message from a show or not get an educational message from a show, in talking about the show Word World, which has a lot of letters and a lot of words, obviously. But in research that was done about that show, it found that when a frog went to space, kids got frustrated if he didn't have on a spacesuit. But if he had on a spacesuit, they were willing to accept it. So we have to do a lot of research to think about what kids will find plausible?
Absolutely. And there's a lot that goes into the research for any of our educational programs within public television. Certainly, there's the research about what do children really need to learn to be successful, and then how do they acquire that learning. But then there's also a great body of research about, you know, what are kids attending to on the screen? Are they looking to the upper right-hand corner or the upper left-hand corner? What are they following with their eyes? So there's a great amount of research in all of those areas. But the storyline for any given program also has to work for the age of the child as appropriate. And with Word World, it was in the Rocket to the Moon episode. And before it was ever created, those producers put the little characters on popsicle sticks and go out and try it with children to see if it works. And without the space helmet, Frog couldn't breathe and the story didn't work. So it's just shows we have to really think about those kids.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back to our conversation about educational media in a moment. With me, Trista Peitzman, pre-K through 12 coordinator at Iowa Public Television, and Douglas Gentile, a research scientist and associate professor of developmental psychology at Iowa State University. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about educational media, what it can do for our kids, what it can't do for our kids, some of the negative side effects, some of the positive side effects. We would love to hear your insights on ways that you've been able to harness educational media in a positive way in your home. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me is Douglas Gentile. He's a research scientist and associate professor of developmental psychology at Iowa State University, and Trista Peitzman, pre-K through 12 coordinator at Iowa Public Television. And let's get to an email here. This is from Tim in Ames. He says, my 2.5-year-old son loves to spend a few minutes each day with educational apps on my iPad, which he calls Daddy's Book. His favorite apps teach letter recognition and sounds, word meanings, shape identification, and cause and effect relating to everyday objects. I'm amazed at the speed with which he immediately figures out new applications I've downloaded, and we have a lot of fun going through the content together. I'm curious about what the latest research suggests about toddlers and learning on digital devices. Doug?
Well, I think he's summed it up pretty nicely, actually, that the latest research is that kids learn very quickly whatever they do. They do love these types of things, and children are spending more and more time with all of these different types of electronic media than ever before in human history. They have far greater access to them than before in human history, and really, they are able to get more benefits from them. But then there's also, you know, we've got to be careful about what the potential negatives are.
I recently read an article that was saying that every kid should have an iPad, and we should just replace TV time with an iPad.
Well, I mean, there certainly is some benefit to being interactive. And there is benefit to giving more control over to the kids in terms of letting them, select what types of apps and what types of programming they like, as long as there's still some parental control used there. But some other research is also showing that the earlier we get kids in front of a screen may be one of the predictors of whether they end up with attention deficit disorders when they hit school age. There's some very well-conducted longitudinal studies looking at children from the time they're infants up until about age 7 or 8. And the kids who are spending more time with screens earlier end up being the ones diagnosed with attention deficit disorders later on. So I think it's something we do want to be very careful about. Even though there are benefits, that's not something the parents, that's not something you would notice. You wouldn't know that that's happening because it's a very slow, long-term effect. But it certainly is one of the potential downfalls.
Well, and there are these amazing apps out there. And I find that, you know, some of them are great. Some of them are not great. Some of them are boring. If they're, you know, that's been a problem that I've run into with letter recognition and things like that. So you have to really search around to find something that is educational and will capture your child's attention, which I know is also a challenge in educational television as well. But the thing, you know, on my phone, I've only put on educational apps and games. And when my son is bored while we're waiting for his sister somewhere, he'll play with my phone, and I feel pretty good about what he's doing. Well, one day he had his dad's phone, which had Angry Birds on it, and became completely obsessed. And so there seem to be these problems, at least for me, with the accidental introduction and the fact that some of these games can really grab your kid's imagination and just not let go. Doug, when you look at video games like Angry Birds, is there anything positive that a child can get out of that?
Well, I think it's important that we're not just dichotomizing games and shows into good versus bad, because there is a big middle ground of benign. And I think Angry Birds probably fits in there. There is nothing educational about it, although you could perhaps make a claim that kids are learning about trajectory and velocity. But I don't think they probably are. But many games like that, there's, you know, sports games, they're really just benign. They are good for entertainment. They are very good at that, but they aren't providing any particular benefit or any particular harm.
This is an email from Laura. Have studies looked at the difference between children who watch shows independently versus children who watch shows with their parents and then talk about those shows afterward? I'm wondering if parental involvement is a mitigating factor in relational aggression and other negative outcomes. And I'd like to hear from both of you on this. So, Trista?
Yes, absolutely. I would say that co-viewing with your child does mitigate a lot of those negative influences as well as really promotes those positive ones. I know this from watching with my own children where they might get excited about a product they see on television. And then when I explain what it really is, then they can take your approach and your attitude toward it. So, you know, that co-viewing, like we talked about, is very important. I know that there have been research studies that have been completed about that, and maybe Doug can go into those a little bit more. I do want to say something about Tim as well, talking mm-hmm. about his young child on devices like an iPad. From my experience on the ground, those younger children, those preschoolers, are very adept at using an iPad compared to, let's say, a laptop device. And there are some great apps out there. One that was just launched by PBS yesterday is a PBS Play and Learn app that is really designed for parents of preschoolers to help them with early math and early literacy skills. It promotes that parent-child interaction. And I loved how he said that he plays with his child, because that is so key, especially at that age, and thinking about what is age appropriate. This is a free app, and it's also a bilingual app. Android as well as iOS device. So that's just one great app I'd like to promote to him.
All right. And Doug, back to the question of parents watching with their kids.
Sure.
Do you think that makes an impact with the relational aggression?
Well, we've done a number of studies in my lab and several others around the country as well. And it turns out that there are actually four different ways in which parents can monitor their children's media. And co-viewing is one, where you sit and watch with them or sit and play with them. The second is setting limits on the amount of time. The third is setting limits on the content of what they're watching. And the fourth is what's called active mediation. And that is the talking about what you see or hear, talking about the themes, talking about the meaning behind it, talking about what the reality is behind it. And the interesting thing in the research is that not all four of these are equally good. Co-viewing alone actually tends to be bad. If you just sit and watch with your kids, then you're giving silent approval to whatever's being seen. So what actually matters most is this act of mediation, that when you sit and you watch with your kids, that you do discuss it, you do discuss those themes. And when parents do that, that does mitigate almost all of the negative effects of media, and it enhances the positive effects, that children learn more from educational and pro-social media if the parents sit, watch with them, and talk to them about it. But again, the important caveat is if you just sit and watch but don't talk about it, then it enhances the negative effects.
Oh, that's fascinating. Now, of course, you also lose the benefit of being able to shower if if you spend a lot of time co-viewing and interacting. Does it have to be every time, or does the positive effect of that linger if you do it sometimes?
I think the positive effect lingers, but also part of what's happening here is not just that you are able to help children understand the show better or to get the message out of it you want them to get out of it, but also you're learning about the show so that then you recognize, okay, this show pretty much, you know, 90% of the time, I'm not worried about anything it says or shows, so then I can go take a shower when it's on. But if you don't really know the programs all that well, then you know, it is worth sitting and watching with them. And beyond that, just these restrictive monitoring types, setting limits on how much time they're allowed to watch or play the, you know, iPad, and setting limits on what the content is, those also are a powerful protective factor for kids. So parents really are in a much more powerful position than they realize.
Trista, with so many hours of programming to fill now, and, you know, so many options, because, of course, most public television stations around the country, like IPTV, have more than one channel to work with, does that create any frustrations for you as far as, you know, you're doing research on these shows, you're getting feedback on these shows, but you also have to fill 12 hours a day?
You know, I don't think there's any lack of good quality programming to fill our airways. In fact, oftentimes I wish I had a few more hours, because we do have teachers that want a certain program at a certain time and care providers that would like a different program at a different time. And certainly parents that say, I want a program at 7 in the morning or I want it at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And so I don't think there's any problem in having a wealth of wonderful quality educational programs at each level. There are always new programs coming out. I know there's a great preschool math-centered program coming out this fall called Peg Plus Cat, which is just an adorable program. It has a lot of social, emotional, and music skills wrapped into it as well, and that's going to be really fun. But I'm already worried about what are we going to take out of the schedule to make sure that Peg Plus Cat has a place. And so I think you do see our air becoming better and better quality as we are able to fill it with programs based on research, so we know what is the best quality programming for children.
Doug? I guess I'd like to point out a theme that has come up over and over, but it hasn't been addressed really specifically. And Trista, you keep making it very clear that all of these programs that public broadcasting is putting on come with research to test really how good they are, whether children get the messages, and the programs are then changed based on the research. That is remarkable in programming, because the other networks, the for-profit networks, don't do that same level of research on their programs. And so this is one of the things that makes public television so important. And it's also, if I may step out on a limb, say it's one of the reasons why it's important that the public support it, because it's not just airing a creative idea. It's airing a creative idea with a research component to make sure that children are really getting the benefit. And that is something worth supporting.
Exactly. And thank you for pointing that out, because, for instance, in the 2005 to 2010 grant award to CBS or CPB and PBS from the U.S. Department of Education, it was actually required that 1/4 of the funding be devoted to rigorous studies and evaluations of these programs and resources. And so that's where this effort is coming from. And much of that research can be found on our PBS pages, PBS Parents, found on our Ready to Learn pages on our website. So it's all free and available for everyone. And that's the power behind it, is educating parents about what we know truly is good and helpful for their child.
On some of the for-profit networks, you will see, especially the ones designed for very young children, you will see something that pops up at the beginning of the show that tells you why this show is good for your kids. So, Doug, given that PBS is doing all of this research, for-profit channels don't have to do that kind of research. Are you saying that that's not happening on these shows? Are these little informative blurbs not telling us the truth?
Well, I think it depends on the network. It depends on the particular show. You know, the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, I promise you, does not have a research
and
agenda.
It does not have a blurb that precedes it that tells you that. So.
And I don't know what the requirements are for that blurb. It may just be that the producer says, this is what we're trying to teach, which is different from saying, and our research has shown that it actually is successful.
And often I've noticed those blurbs say narrative arc or something like that, which I guess most shows that tell a story would help us out with. There are a lot of older shows, and Nick sent this email from Chicago. He says that when he was a kindergarten teacher, he used PBS Kids Online a lot. And he said the depth of skills and content provided was astounding, and retention by my students was anything short of amazing. Also, Mr. Rogers provided an amazing role model to the students. Old shows I watched as a kid still rang true for my own students. And that's an interesting question to me because, for example, with my kids, I tried to introduce Mr. Rogers, and I love it. They found it to be really slow. And I'm guessing that that's because compared to so much that they can watch on television today, it is slow. Doug, has the ability to engage kids with some of these shows that used to be so engaging to us 20 years ago, has that changed because of the media environment?
Yeah, there are different ways we could talk about it. Some people call it the MTV effect, that once MTV came along and started showing very quick edits of about 1 per second, that we got used to a really high level of visual stimulation very quickly, and we start finding slower paced programming to be boring. And that's, of course, one of the things that goes into perhaps the influence on attention deficit disorders, that the younger we get kids expecting a high level of stimulation, that could end up being a real problem down the road when they're supposed to sit in a classroom and not pay attention to the child fidgeting next to them.
We have just a moment left. Doug, what would your advice be for parents of preschoolers? And with all of this media, all of these screens available, how do you navigate?
Well, I think part of it is that the American Academy of Pediatrics, the recommendations seem to be sound, that, you know, that's no televisions in children's bedrooms ever, children 2 and under really should have very seriously limited screen time. And then for preschool and elementary school age children, total screen time limited to 1 hour a day of quality programming. And for secondary school age, 2 hours a day of total screen time. And what do you know is quality programming? Well, I think you know it when you see it. And so sitting and watching with them and talking about it really is the best thing you could be doing.
And Trista, you spend a lot of time educating parents. So what is your best advice?
My best advice would be, as Doug said, you know it when you see it. So if parents have very little time, sitting down and watching the program with their child, one episode is usually enough to know what that whole program is going to be about. That's a great start. If they have a little more time, going online to pbsparents.org is a wonderful resource. It has a whole section on children and media, talking about how to find good quality educational apps, you know, what's appropriate for television viewing, you know, some great articles that can really help parents navigate this world.
Trista, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Trista Peitzman, pre-K through 12 coordinator at Iowa Public Television. And Doug Gentile, thank you.
My pleasure.
Douglas Gentile is a research scientist and associate professor of developmental psychology at Iowa State University. We've been talking about educational media today. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support today from Jason Burns in Ames and John Pemble in Des Moines. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow, it's Horticulture Day with Richard Giron and Donald Lewis. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.
What are we eating again?
Martha Speaks.
Hey, Joe, what do you know? Joe.
She's not always right, but still that Martha speaks.
Hi there.
She's got a voice, she's ready to shout. Martha will tell you what it's all about. Sometimes wrong, but seldom in doubt. Martha will tell you what it's all about. That dog's unique.
Testing, 1, 2.
Hear her speak. Martha speaks and speaks and speaks and speaks and speaks.